I had a life sentence plus 170 years. You know, it didn't really register until they start handcuffing me. Them just saying they want to ask me questions, you know, okay, sure, you know. They pretty much beat me till I was unconscious. And then they beat on the beanhole, and the police came, the guards came, and they drugged me out of there, and they put me in another cell. I was there 2 weeks, and I ended up getting me a knife. I'm not just to just let someone kill me.
When one thinks of the warring Crips and the Blood street gangs, you may think of Los Angeles. But you almost certainly don't think of Tulsa, Oklahoma. But in the early 1990s, North Tulsa, Oklahoma was a maelstrom of gang violence. On September 10, 1994, members of the Crips street gang were holding a house party on East 29th Street North in Tulsa, Oklahoma, when a maroon-colored car drove past and several shots were fired from the back seat. 19-year-old Karen Summers was fatally shot in the back. Two 16-year-olds, Alonzo Johnson and Kenneth Price, were wounded. Urban violence is not what usually comes to mind when we think of Oklahoma. We think of Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh,
or the Grapes of Wrath.
Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there.
Or of Oral Roberts.
Cause I can just feel it.
You won't find any black faces on these popular images of the Sooner State, but perception isn't reality. Tulsa, Oklahoma was once known as Negro Wall Street. In the early 20th century, it was the home of the most prosperous African-American business community in the nation. In 1921, Tulsa was the scene of a race riot in which the Oklahoma state government, with the assistance of Tulsa's white residents, massacred hundreds of black people and razed the black business district within hours. The riot was one of the most devastating massacres in the history of the United States. The community never fully recovered. Decades later, DeMarco Carpenter was born into this community. In 1994, at age 17, he didn't know that he would be the next victim of racism in Tulsa. Following the drive-by homicide of Karen Summers, police recovered shell casings from a .380 caliber weapon in the street. The next day, police went to the home of Michael Wilson, a member of the rival Blood street gang. A maroon-colored Ford Taurus was parked in the driveway, and records showed Wilson rented it on September 7, 1994. Police caught Wilson trying to hide a .380 caliber semi-automatic pistol under his shirt. Wilson was arrested after he said he was the only person to have driven the car and that he did not loan the gun to anyone else. Despite his statement, they also arrested 17-year-old DeMarco Carpenter and 17-year-old Malcolm Scott, both of whom were associated with members of the Bloods gang. Police suspected Scott in another unsolved murder committed before the murder of Summers. Here is how DeMarco remembers that day.
In September of 1994, I was questioned and arrested for the murder of a 19-year-old Karen Summers, who was, she had a 3-month-old child at the time, and It was weird how it all played out, because the night of the crime, me and Malcolm, who's my co-defendant on this case that I served 22 years for, but me, Malcolm, Melissa Shields, and Francine Sharp, we went to this Quick Trip, and that's when we encountered Michael Wilson, Richard Harjo, and Billy Alverson. And you know, at the time, it didn't seem like nothing, but, you know, I got out the car, talked to him, and he was limping, and, you know, he was like, hey, what's up? You know, I knew Michael from growing up in my neighborhood. I knew Richard Harjo from Rogers and actually middle school, too. But, you know, our encounter was brief, and after that, you know, we headed in our separate directions. But it was 2 days later when I was questioned and arrested. And why I say it was weird, because as I entered the precinct on the east side of town, I saw Michael Wilson. So I said, hey, man, what you here for? He said, man, I don't know. I said, oh, man, I don't know what I'm here for either. So I went in a room in the back along with my mom and my auntie. And that's when they began asking me questions and asking me about Karen Summers. And I told them I wasn't familiar with her or the situation. And that's when they told me that, well, the guy in the other room said that, you know, he gave you 3 bullets and so on and so forth. And that guy was Michael Wilson. So, I, you know, my auntie, she worked in the Tulsa County Jail at the time. And she was like, my mom knew I didn't do this. She knew I was home with her tonight. And also who was there, it was several other witnesses that was at my house that night who never was called. But my auntie was like, yeah, he's willing to take a polygraph, you know, ballistic. I'm not sure what you call it when they do the little ballistics on your hand to see if you have
gunshot residue.
Uh-huh. But they wanted, my auntie said, he's willing to do that too. And I said, yes, I am, because I didn't do this. And I have no knowledge of this crime. And, you know, they still arrested me and sent me to the county jail at 17. I was like, wow, whoa. You know, it didn't really register until they start handcuffing me. Them just saying they want to ask me questions, you know, okay, sure, you know. But them to handcuff me and then, you know, haul me off and go to the county jail and, you know, it was horrifying. You know, when I got to the county jail and I seen the dingy walls and, you know, some of the trustees in the little dirty orange jumpsuit that was too small, you know, I was terrified. And at the time I was 6'3", 165 pounds at this time, back in 94. And I also had a colostomy bag because I had got shot 10 years prior to being arrested.
On September 13, ballistics testing linked a bullet recovered from Summers' body to the gun confiscated from Wilson. Police told Wilson that they believed Scott and Carpenter were responsible for the shooting. Wilson then said that he gave Scott and Carpenter ammunition and later, at their request, held the gun used in the shooting. Carpenter and Scott were charged with first-degree murder, 2 counts of shooting with intent to kill, and use of a vehicle to facilitate the discharge of a weapon. Wilson was charged with being an accessory to the crime. He pled guilty in March 1995 and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Carpenter and Scott went to trial in Tulsa County District Court in the fall of 1995. One of the victims, Kenneth Price, and a witness, Rashun Williams, identified Carpenter and Scott as being in the car at the time shots were fired. Wilson testified that he was not in the car, but gave them bullets prior to the shooting and later hid the gun for them. On November 9, 1995, the jury convicted Scott and Carpenter of all charges. They were sentenced to life in prison plus 170 years. He was sent to the Oklahoma State Penitentiary, nicknamed Big Mac, and located in McAlester, Oklahoma. The prison had been the scene of riots and was known for its daily violence.
Yes, everyone goes to McAlester because of your time. I had a life sentence plus 170 years. So because of that life sentence, they sent me to McAlester. And when we pulled up to McAlester, you know, it looked like death. You know, it was worse than what the visions and the pictures that I see in the movies. It was worse than that. The prison itself looked like death. It was late at night, and just so happened someone was being executed. So the prison was really, really quiet as I'm walking down this run, being led to my cell, where it was actually a bathroom with some bunks in it. But as I'm being led to this cell, you know, it was really quiet. I did see a guy that I knew so from the street, so that kind of made me feel a little bit better, but you know, the prison itself looked like that.
Was it a scary experience for you?
Yes, it was to me. It was scary because I didn't know. I went to the county at 17. At 18, I had got I had a birthday in prison too. I mean, in Tulsa County Jail. So when I was 17, right, because of this case, who this case was, the guys, Karen Summer, she had relatives who was well-known Crips. They was OGs from Hoover. So as soon as I turned 17, they put me in an adult tank, and the guys in there, they were familiar with my face and who I was and what case I was on. So they pretty much beat me till I was unconscious, and then they beat on the beanhole, and the police came, the guards came, and they drugged me out of there, and they put me in another cell. So I'm at McAllister. I'm 19. And, you know, I've never been in trouble. I have never been arrested. So to be in prison for a crime that I didn't do and have a life in 170 years, it was horrifying. What kept me strong is between my grandma and the faith that she instilled in us, the morals, and the fact that I believe that God did not allow me to get shot all those times, November 21st, 1993, to survive that, to come to prison with a life sentence and die in prison. And that's what kept me strong.
So, did you see any violence during your time there at McAllister?
Oh, yes, definitely. I saw a guy get stabbed, and McAllister was really racist, too. The prison was ran. It had a lot of racism, but, you know, the whites ran the prison at this time. You know, and some of the guards, they would let, you know, if the white guys was into it with whoever, the guards would open those doors and let those white guys run in there and stab blacks. It was really racist, and it was really, you know, it was really hard. You know, because you could get into it behind a basketball game or a football game on TV or just something just so small and a bed or whatever, and the guards would let those guys come in there and stab you. It was really sad. But I saw a lot of guys get stabbed, and it was to the point that I was there 2 weeks, and I ended up getting me a knife, and I kept it on me at all times. Even when I went in the shower, because the shower, it was like a 6 or 7 man shower. And that's where a lot of fights happened, a lot of stabbings happened. And, you know, so I was like, no, I'm not supposed to just let someone kill me because of this case. I was thinking that somebody was always plotting on me because of my case after that incident in the county where they beat me unconscious and had blood coming out of my nose and mouth. So I was like, no, I'm not going to be a victim of circumstances or a victim of this. And I didn't even do this. So I kept me a knife.
Folks, I want to talk to you today about a product I really like. They're called RX Bars. I started trying them out, 8 or 9 months ago, and I really like them. In fact, during this month-long trial that I just got done covering, I packed up my computer bag full of RX bars and would snack on them during mid-afternoon and mid-morning. And they were just great. In fact, they were so great, the TV cameraman that sat next to me kept bumming them off of me. He loved them. He's hooked, and so am I. When I first started eating RX bars, I wasn't sure if I really should or not, because I gave up all sweets 5.5 years ago. And I haven't had any candy, I haven't had any desserts, and I'm thinking, well, are RX bars like cheating? I mean, is that like a sweet? And then I read their ingredients, and they're healthy stuff like egg whites and dates and nuts. I mean, there's no added sugar. They're just really wonderful. I really enjoy them. They're great for road trips. I'll take them with me, and I'll have them to snack on. Or, you know, like when I had to go down to Texas to do some reporting couple months ago, and I brought them on the airplane with me, and they're just good to have all the way around. RX Bars want to build things the right way. RX Bar believes in the power of transparency and lets the core ingredients do all the talking, with all of them listed on the front of the packaging. You'll likely recognize RX Bar at the shelf. They're the ones with As I said, egg whites for protein, dates to bind, nuts for texture, and other delicious ingredients like unsweetened chocolate, real fruit, and spices like sea salt or cinnamon. Turns out, real food ingredients actually taste really good. And believe me, they do. I just love them. RX bars are gluten-free, soy-free, and dairy-free. Whether you like sweet or savory, chocolate or fruit flavors, there's definitely an RX bar out there for you. There's no artificial colors, artificial flavors, preservatives, or fillers. RX bars are great for a number of occasions. Breakfast on the go, snack at the office to push you through that 3 p.m. slump, or just throw in your bag on the plane. Toss in your backpack for a bike ride or a hike, or right before or after a workout. Egg white protein stands out as a source of protein that it's easy for your body to absorb. RX bars come in 14 delicious varieties, including mango pineapple, chocolate hazelnut, peanut butter and berries, chocolate sea salt. Wonderful. Gotta try that one, guys. Coconut chocolate, mixed berry, blueberry, maple sea salt, apple cinnamon, mint chocolate chip, peanut butter chocolate, which I really like as well, and coffee chocolate. And now they have seasonal flavors too. And now RX Bar has debuted an RX nut butter, which contains a few simple and similar ingredients like egg whites, fruits, and nuts. Each single serve packet contains delicious creamy nut butter with 9 grams of high quality protein. It's squeezable and spreadable, pairs great with fruit, rice cakes, pretzels, or straight out of the pouch. Our nut butter flavors are honey cinnamon peanut butter, vanilla almond butter, and, you know, I can't recommend this firm enough. I really enjoy their stuff. I keep it in my office at home in the studio where I record these, and I just really recommend them to you. For 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/suspect and enter the promo code SUSPECT at checkout. Once again, folks, for 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/suspect and enter the promo code SUSPECT at checkout. One more time, folks. For 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/suspect and enter the promo code SUSPECT at checkout. Try it. You'll really like it.
DeMarco Carpenter's conviction was upheld on appeal in 1997. By that time, the original suspect in the case, Michael Wilson, had been sentenced to death for the fatal beating of a store clerk in Tulsa. Two other men, Billy Alverson and Richard Harjo, were also convicted of that murder. Alverson was sentenced to death, while Harjo was sentenced to life in prison without parole. In 2014, Carpenter and Scott filed a petition seeking a new trial, citing recantations by the state's key witnesses. Williams and Price, who had testified that they saw the defendants in the maroon Taurus, had recanted in 2010. They said that police threatened to convict them on other charges and forced them to falsely identify Scott and Carpenter. Wilson had also recanted. While in jail in Tulsa County in 1995, both before and after the trial, Wilson admitted to another inmate that Carpenter and Scott were not involved in the shooting. Eric Cullen, a private investigator for Carpenter and Scott, interviewed Wilson in July 2007. In that interview, Wilson said that he knew who committed the crime and that Scott and Carpenter were not involved. In January 2014, 2 days before he was executed for the beating of the store clerk, Wilson gave a video-recorded interview to the Oklahoma Innocence Project. Wilson said he was in the car with Alverson and Harjo. He said that Alverson drove and Harjo was in the front seat, while he himself fired the shots from the back seat that killed Summers and wounded Johnson and Price. Wilson said the shooting was in retaliation for an earlier incident in which members of the Crips street gang had shot him in the leg a few days earlier. The petition for a new trial also cited a letter written by Alverson in 2010, admitting that he drove the rented car from which the shots were fired. Alverson was executed on January 6, 2011, for his role in the store clerk murder. Harjo testified at a hearing on the petition for a new trial that that he was in the car with Alverson and Wilson, and that Wilson fired the shots. In May 2016, Tulsa County District Court Judge Sharon Holmes granted the petition, vacated Scott's and Carpenter's convictions, and declared them factually innocent. On May 9, 2016, Scott and Carpenter were released on bond. The prosecution appealed. On November 10, 2016, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals upheld Judge Holmes' ruling, stating that the state's case at the trial was weak and the evidence and circumstances that have been developed and presented to the trial court do nothing to strengthen the state's position. In July 2017, Scott and Carpenter filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Tulsa and two former detectives.
Well, folks, we're joined today by Brooke Giddings, a friend of mine, who produces several podcasts. What podcasts do you produce these days?
These days, I host A&E's Cold Case Files, the podcast. So like the TV show podcast version. It comes out on Tuesdays. And actually, the new season's coming out next week. And then I host, produce, and everything, the podcast Convicted, except for the music. And the first season was wildly popular. It was about a guy named Richard Nicholas. And he actually had Christina Gutierrez as an attorney the year before Adnan Syed did. So it was such an interesting experience. But currently, season two of Convicted is DeMarco's story. And DeMarco was wrongfully convicted and he was exonerated. But I'm a social worker. And so what's important to me is the why. Why did this happen? Why did this happen to DeMarco? You know, what were the influences? So it's kind of an exploration into the factors that led to his wrongful conviction.
And you and I are kind of an anomaly within the true crime movement.
Yes.
In that we are ones that look at wrongful convictions. I mean, with this podcast, obviously, we investigate wrongful convictions. And then in between seasons, we profile exonerations. And there's not very many people doing that these days, is there?
Yeah, I think that I think it's not sexy enough. True crime is so popular right now. But people tend to like the gory, mysterious details. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. You know, I met DeMarco in at the Innocence Conference in Memphis, what was it, April? And he just struck me as a super nice guy. I didn't get a chance to talk to him for very long, but I really liked him. And of course, I interviewed him earlier this week and just struck me as a very nice person.
And he's also 6'5 and 200 pounds, 250 pounds, whatever. So he's huge. So he looks intimidating. The minute he opens his mouth, you know that he's like this giant teddy bear. He's such a nice guy.
Yeah, we were about the same size. I kind of fell for you, Brooke. You were sitting in between the two of us at the conference, these two great big men. But
you know what? I'm small but mighty.
Yeah, there you go. Tell me about DeMarco's case, because you told me something that was interesting the other day. You said, I know DeMarco's case better than he knows his case.
I do, actually. So I also met DeMarco at the Innocence Conference, but not last year, the year before in San Diego. And he told me that he wanted to do an interview on Actual Innocence, the podcast. So I called him and I interviewed him, and he just has this charisma about him. And he's so nice and cooperative. And I was like, DeMarco, do you want to be my co-host? And he was like, okay. And so DeMarco co-hosted Actual Innocence with me for a while. And then he was like looking for ways to get his story out there. But he was kind of lost. Do you know what I mean? He was like, oh, maybe I could pay someone to do a documentary. And he has a book in progress. And I said, DeMarco, I don't know how to make a documentary, but I can make a long form podcast that's kind of like an audio documentary. And then, you know, I had told him about season one of Convicted and how it all worked out. And he was like, okay, let's do it. I said, the worst that can happen is I will lose money. So, like, I mean, what could it hurt? So we are creating this long form podcast about DeMarco's story, and it's been such an enlightening experience because I went to Oklahoma, where DeMarco's from, and I met his family, and they were the nicest people I have ever met. I spent, I think, 3 days there, and that entire time I was there, no one I was with looked like me, but I never felt like an outsider.
Well, that's cool.
Actually, DeMarco, when he was 15, was shot in the stomach, and the doctors told his mom he was going to die, and obviously he didn't. But he grew up in the north side of Tulsa, which at that time, it had lots of gangs. And everybody was either in a gang or knew somebody in a gang, or you had friends who you didn't stop being friends with because they joined a gang. So there's a lot of gang associations going on.
Now, was DeMarco part of a gang?
DeMarco was associated with a gang, but he was not a member.
Okay. Tell me what the difference is.
Right. Okay. So, spoiler alert for Convicted Season 2, Episode 2. I interviewed like 10 gang members. And I equated it to this. The average age when a person joins a gang is 12 or 13. And the way you get initiated into the gang, they call it getting quoted on, is you get your butt kicked, like by other gang members. And DeMarco says that he never got initiated into a gang. However, he did get beat up by one. So he didn't. This is my theory. I think it's possible that they were initiating him and he didn't know. He never asked to be part of a gang, but he had tons of friends who were part of a gang because everybody in North Tulsa was in a gang. So that's where his neighborhood was, where the Crips were. So he was associated with a lot of Crips because they were his friends. Like they'd grown up together, and he wasn't like, oh, you're in a gang now, bye. He just, you know, was friendly with them.
Okay. He was a standout athlete as well at the time, wasn't he?
He thinks he was. I have no evidence of that.
Well, he tells me that he'd be in the NBA today if he wasn't ended up in prison.
I love
Of course, him. There's a lot of people who played high school basketball that thought they were going to end up in the NBA. But
when DeMarco was 16 and shot in the stomach, he also almost lost his arm, and he does not have full range of motion with his arm. So I think that career option is unlikely, but at least he would have had more choices.
Okay.
So DeMarco has a friend named Malcolm who is a super nice guy. And they were driving around and they got pulled over. And Malcolm got taken to the station. He was the one driving. And I learned that DeMarco told me that every time anybody got stopped by the police, everybody in the car got handcuffed. And that was mind-boggling to me. And so DeMarco's mom comes and picks him up and she says, you know what? You're not going anywhere tonight because, hey, you already had one close encounter with the police. I want you to just stay home and be safe. DeMarco's mom is amazing. I love her. I love her. She's so nice. So DeMarco said that, you know, he went home. He was hanging out. They had this huge front porch. He was hanging out on the front porch. And his girlfriend, or a girl he was interested in, and another girl came over. And they were talking. And then all of a sudden, Malcolm calls. He's like, Malcolm, come over now. I've got two girls here. So he was telling me, you know, they were hanging out on the porch. And they were talking to these girls. And at one point, they went to Quick Trip, which I guess is kind of like 7-Eleven.
Yeah, Quick Trip's big in Iowa. I'm surprised you don't know that.
No, I have never been to a Quick Trip, and I would never will either. But
why?
Because a lot of bad things apparently happen at Quick Trips. I've read three cases in Oklahoma, and they all involve someone getting killed at a Quick Trip.
Oh, okay. I used to go to Quick Trip all the time when I was in college. I always thought they were kind of nice convenience stores, but okay.
Maybe I would go in Iowa.
Well, there you go.
So they run to Quick Trip. And while they're at Quick Trip, they come across this guy that they know. His name is Mike Wilson. And Mike says hi. He tells them that he is going to, they're like, what's up? And DeMarco said, that girl in that car, that's what's up, or something like that. Like, those were his exact words. And Mike told him that he was looking to get revenge on members of a rival gang. And so DeMarco got his burrito, went back home, because his mom is strict. And him and Malcolm and the girls hung out until like 3 a.m. and then DeMarco's mom made him go to bed. Meanwhile, Mike Wilson, the guy they met at Quick Trip, was involved in a drive-by shooting, and he killed someone and injured 2 other people. DeMarco didn't know that this happened that night, because how would he? And then at like 5 a.m, someone did a drive-by shooting of DeMarco's house. His mom was like, oh my gosh, we were getting shot. And like, it was so interesting hearing her explain, like telling her kids to get on the floor because someone's shooting up their house. Like, it's unimaginable to me. So the next day they find out what happened, that this woman, Karen Summers, had been killed in a drive-by shooting. And the police went to Mike Wilson's house, found the gun on him. Like, he hid it in his shirt. And they let him go.
Why?
I'm working on that. I mean, obviously, he had to either have been an informant or he had some kind of information about this police officer that whatever. But they let him go. And so in order for them to let him go, he had to tell them that what they wanted to hear. And so then Malcolm gets arrested, and then DeMarco gets arrested. I have read the transcripts to their trial. It is absolute BS. I've read like the police questioning of the different witnesses. And it's so funny, because not funny, like, haha, funny, like, that's off. They interviewed people twice, and the detective that let Mike Wilson go, when he interviewed them, they said something totally different than when a different detective interviewed them. Like, I saw Malcolm, or I saw DeMarco. And in the original interview, they couldn't recall. Or this one guy got shot in his butt, and he said he got a perfect view of the driver. But if he got shot at his butt, it's probably not very likely that he was looking in the direction of the car.
No.
So there was definitely a bunch of coerced testimony. And actually, when they filed their petition for actual innocence, those people testified and said, yeah, I was like, they told me if I didn't tell them this thing, that I was going to get arrested for this crime. So Malcolm and DeMarco get arrested. They have a make-believe trial. And they had this weird dual jury. So there's 2 juries, 1 trial. And they are only supposed to pay attention to the stuff, I guess, relating to the person that they are deciding the verdict on, which is impossible because they're humans and all humans have bias. And so that just feels unfair to me in the first place. And they were out less than an hour. They came back both guilty. The entire case was based on the fact that they said Malcolm and DeMarco were in a gang. Like, they had no forensic evidence. They had coerced witnesses. And they kept talking about them being dangerous gang members. It was ridiculous. And so they go to prison. And 6 months later, Mike Wilson kills someone else. And he gets the death penalty. So then, 22 years later, 2 days before he's scheduled to be executed. Mike Wilson confesses.
So then what?
So then he got executed. So DeMarco is a letter writer. Okay, so Malcolm and DeMarco both were writing people because they didn't do it. And they felt like there had to be some way they could get out. And so they ended up connecting with an investigator named Dan Cullen, who did a lot of work for them for free. And Malcolm was represented by the Innocence Project of Oklahoma. And DeMarco had to have a separate attorney just because that's how it works. But they collaborated. And they first went in front of the 3-judge panel. And their conviction was vacated. And so then when they went back to have their trial, they didn't have a trial. I mean, the judge was like, her name is Sharon Holmes. She's an African-American judge in Oklahoma. And I've read a lot of judges' statements, and sometimes I feel like they just cut and paste. But this woman, she gets it. Like, she is one of my favorite judges to read opinions from. And she's like, there's absolutely no evidence that they committed this crime. I wish I had her exact words, because I was like, she just hit the nail on the head. And they got to go home that day.
So what's DeMarco done with himself since he got out of prison?
DeMarco's struggling. So I used to have a podcast called Actual Innocence, and it was a podcast where exonerees would tell their story. And it's so hard when someone goes to prison when they're 17 and comes out when they're almost 40, because they miss the evolution of technology. DeMarco was my podcast co-host, but he didn't know how to use a computer. I do everything on my computer. I pay my bills. I do my banking. I email. I record everything. Everything is electronic nowadays. And so there's a learning curve for people who missed that while they were in prison. So that's one of the things. But he wants to learn. And that's important because he is learning.
All the things that you learn in your 20s, I mean, like social interaction,
life experience,
how to work in a professional environment, those sort of things that you would have totally missed out on.
Yeah, exactly. And I have noticed it is very common for someone who was incarcerated when they were a teenager, when they come out, to still have that kind of teenage mentality.
I've read that. I said, not only with people who are incarcerated being the same emotional age they were when they went in, but also with people with addictions, when the addiction manifests itself, is kind of where their emotional age freezes at.
Yeah, I believe that.
So
my degree is in mental health and addictions.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was a therapist before I was a podcaster. It's so interesting.
I would say the trite saying would be, that sounds really rewarding, but I'm tempted to say that sounds really frustrating.
It is. I worked with children who had experienced pretty intense traumas, so it was hard.
I bet it was.
DeMarco, though, loves life. DeMarco likes to travel. He wants to see everything. He's enthusiastic. He's a hard worker. But the problem is, while the rest of us were gaining life skills, going to college, or learning some kind of trade, DeMarco was in prison. So he's got a pretty big gap on his resume there. And also, what will come into play later is, those 22 years, he didn't pay into Social Security.
Oh.
Right. Because he couldn't. And that's a big issue with people who've been exonerated. If you spent your entire life in prison, you didn't have the opportunity to pay into Social Security. It was hard for him when he first got out, just reacquainting himself with his family. DeMarco has a touch of OCD, which I understand. He needs things to be just where they go. And OCD is an anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, if your surroundings are making you anxious, you control what you can control. And so he has a touch of OCD, and his wife has four children, and four children that live with them, and they're kids. And he gets so stressed sometimes. And, you know, he's like, guys, it's not your fault, but please just put it back. Just put it back. So that's kind of a struggle, the OCD. But I have seen him make big strides in that. Initially, when we would record Actual Innocence, if he would make a mistake, he would have to start all the way over, like every time. And finally, I was like, you know what? You're done.
Well, let me ask you, was he eligible for some sort of compensation for being wrongly convicted?
Yes. He just told me the other day that he has a court date. But this is the problem with compensation for people who are wrongly convicted. If you get out of prison and you don't have anywhere to live, you're not getting, your compensation isn't coming for a couple of years. So what do you do for those 2 years if you get compensated at all?
So right now he's living with, he's married now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's married. He and his family live in Oklahoma City area. And he works in an oil field.
Okay. That's hard work.
It is hard work. And he loves life.
Does he like what he's doing?
No. No, he does not.
Yeah, I can't imagine that being real fulfilling. I mean,
he actually loves podcasting. But we had a hosting issue. So we are taking a little break at the moment while we switch hosts. And I'm hoping that the second season of Convicted is successful for DeMarco, because he really needs that boost.
Well, let's, why don't you make your pitch right now for what people should do?
Okay. So Convicted season one is actually getting remastered right now. I felt like this was the time to do it while we were switching hosts. But Convicted season two, DeMarco's story, episodes 1 and 2 are available. And as soon as we finalize our new host, then we'll start updating them weekly again. But it's such, I learned so much from this podcast. And once I was at a meetup and this person came up to me and she goes, you know what? I don't want to, this is totally a compliment. Like, don't take this wrong. And you know, when someone starts a sentence like that, you expect them to say something negative. But what she said was, I feel like I'm learning with you. She's like, I think you're an intelligent person, but I'm learning what you're learning. And that was a huge compliment. I learned that in Tulsa, in the 1920s, there was a massacre of the African-American community.
Tulsa used to be one of the wealthiest African-American communities in the nation. They called it the Wall Street. Black Wall Street, yeah.
Yeah, and until the white people came and shut it down. And so,
our high school history teachers never told us about that, did they?
They did not. And I actually, Convicted season 2, episode 2, starts out talking about Black Wall Street, because I am really interested in the why. And I also interviewed, like I said, in that 10 gang members. And can I tell you, I have never felt so much respect before, ever. They were polite. They were respectful. All of the people that I talked to. And that's not what you think of when you think of a gang member.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of misperceptions. You know, I early in my career, I covered courts and crime, and I interacted with some gangs. And what I found was that gangs tend to be surrogate families.
Yes, exactly. That every single one of the people that I asked why they joined a gang was because they had no father in their home. Mom was overextended, and they wanted to feel like they belonged. They wanted to have some kind of power, some kind of control, and a family structure. Yeah, I think DeMarco, what is in store for DeMarco is experiencing life, making the most of the time he has now, because no one knows the value of time more than someone who had 20 years stolen from them.
Yeah. Did prison change him, you think?
Okay. I'm going to be very honest. I don't think it changed his personality. I don't think it changed that he's a good person, that he's nice, that he's respectful. What I do think, though, is if DeMarco had not been wrongly convicted, he would not be as successful in life as he is now.
And why do you say that?
The prospects for a gang-associated Black teenager in North Tulsa living in poverty are not so great. And I think that DeMarco is pretty impressionable. And I think he could have been manipulated into doing things that would have maybe got him in trouble for real, for something he actually did do. Not because he did it, but because he was around it. Do you know what I mean?